Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Sober through the grace of God and sponsorship in AA since the 10th of December, 1967. For that, I'm very grateful. I went over this morning with my wife and visited my sponsor, and he is 89 years old, and he's 54 years sober. And still active, still going to meetings. And his sister came over to take him to lunch, and she is 94 years old and 56 years sober. So the two of them had 110 years of sobriety going out to lunch. And that's pretty cool. You've already heard a lot about AA and Al-Anon and do this, so we'll do our best to try to cover some territory that wasn't covered before. Prescott brings back a lot of memories to me. I did a lot of drinking in Prescott as a young man, but it was a long time ago. I went down that street down by the river. My next-door neighbor's family had a big compound right on the river. And Danny and I, we snuck down there, and during the winter, when the place is supposed to be closed, you know, we'd come down here and drink in the wintertime, bring girls down, and so I have a lot of memories, but they were 45, 50 years ago. That's a, brought back, just driving down the street brought back a lot of memories. I started drinking when I was 14 years old. I was a small kid when I entered high school. I was 4'11", 95 pounds. I was second smallest kid in my class. Biggest mouth, but smallest body. And, you feel insecure. You're never quite good at the sports. I was one of seven kids. I think Mom wanted us to get to school early. So, you know, I think I was on the cusp of where you were, whether you go to school that year or not, you know, but she wanted us to go. And I always felt like everybody else knew a little bit more about living than I did. I felt like they had a meeting every day to decide what they were going to do, and I always missed the meeting. Everybody else kind of, I was comparing my inside with their outside. And I went to a high school. I went to a military high school on a college campus. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. We had fraternities. I don't know what, it was really odd, but we drank our brains out. And of my five closest buddies in high school, four are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. I mean, you know, of my graduating class of 124, we have a dozen members of AA. I mean, that's a pretty high. We had a lot of alcoholism, but we had a lot of recovery. I loved alcohol. When I had my first drink, it was just like, it was kind of more than an improvement. It's kind of like a sex change operation. I just, you know, it just kind of altered everything. It just, everything looked differently. I had a sense of ease and comfort that I had never experienced before. And all of a sudden, the kid who maybe was a little bit awkward and was worried about what you thought of me, I didn't, you know. I just started from that point on. I just drank as much and as often as I could. And by the time I finished high school, I had a reputation, you know, as a heavy drinker. And I'd been in car accidents. I made false ID cards. I, you know, my whole personality was kind of built around my drinking. And my heroes were those Second World War guys that came back. You know, my dad and his friends. You know, they worked hard, played hard, had a good time, started businesses. They were active in their communities and they were attractive. Men and women. Cocktail parties were the order of the day, and, you know, much of our booze we stole from our parents, you know, and then we made false ID cards and all that. I didn't think I had a drinking problem. I thought my drinking problem was because I was underage, and if you got caught, either by my father or by the police, you know, no one gave a damn if you got three drinks or 30 drinks, you know. I never wanted to get caught with three drinks. It never made sense to me, so I thought my over-drinking had to do with the fact that I really wasn't allowed to drink. I went away to school, and part of how I made that decision was to kind of get away from the authority in my life. I was at a meeting this morning, and I get a kick out of, and it's a, we call it issues and tissues. It's a problem-solution meeting, and there's a lot of young sobriety in it, and they bring up problems that they have, and, I mean, how the young guys react about being told to do anything. You know, I mean, they all feel like, and there were new guys, and they were talking about how they felt like AA was like they still had their mother looking over their shoulder. You know, they had to go to meetings, that they had to, you know, it was, you know, and I think of today what an opportunity it is. I mean, that it's a freedom producer rather than, a, you know, the opposite. And But I went away to school. My drinking didn't get normal. You would have a different talker tonight. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I was in the yearbook with my class ring, and I walked out in the middle of my senior year, which is kind of all our story. We're good enough. We interview well. We just don't work well. You know. We can get in situations that we can't stay in. You know, we can get in marriages. We can get in jobs. We can get in schools, and we can get in churches, but we don't always do a very good job of finishing things. And I was a class drunk. I had three guys petition to have me removed from engineering school. They used my room as a study hall. I was just never in it. It's just a joke today. I think, oh my God, my wife, Linda, who was almost your Al-Anon speaker, she has almost 42 years in Al-Anon. And, a neat lady. And we have three kids that are almost 40, 38, and 28. And they have 90 years of sobriety between the three of them. Or no, six of them. I don't know what they have. The oldest has 22. The middle one is 18. And the other child has 11. And so my wife was a carrier, I think. Well, none of us were alcoholic when we met her, so I don't, kind of like Tomaine Mary or whatever it was. But I got to experience the other side of that. When my kids were little crap heads, would go to school and what I did to my parents, I just couldn't shut my drinking down. It was too important to me. I had tried, I got diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. I didn't believe it. It didn't make sense to me. I mean, an alcoholic to me was someone I couldn't even identify with. It had to be someone who was a lot older. It had to be someone who had a lot more serious problems than I did. 19 didn't fit with anything that I did. When I left Notre Dame, I came home. I finished school at St. Thomas University. When I finished school, my dad asked me to leave the house. He said, "I love you, but I don't like you." Wasn't quite that brutal, but he said, "You're just a pain in the neck." He said, "We got seven kids in the family. You don't follow the rules. He said, "You got to leave." And I got a job at a liquor store and have to use your gifts. And this turned out to be the last year of my drinking. I'm 22 years old, 23 years old. I'm kind of at odds trying to figure out what I'm going to do. I was supposed to be in the service. I was drafted. I was in ROTC. I was supposed to be commissioned as an officer when I left school. And they would have drafted me as a private had I not done something. So I got into officer candidate school, and I'm waiting to get, to go off to Vietnam or wherever the hell we're going. And they lost my physical. A guard unit opened up, and they lost my physical. I took it again. The fourth time I took the physical, they failed me. I mean, how lucky was that I didn't have to go to Vietnam? But during my last year, I worked at the liquor store for 4 or 5 months. I'm drinking a quart a day. I'm living in an apartment with a couple of guys. I'm driving drunk. I'm in bad shape. I've lost touch with the family, and a lot of, we tell funny stories about alcoholism, but mostly they're just kind of tacky stories, how you treat women, how you are physically, how you treat, that's the high cost of low living. You're just a bum, which is kind of what I was. I lost a job at the liquor store. I went over to Minneapolis, took a job as a waiter. I'm living not on Skid Row, but a pretty close approximation of it. I'm shacked up with waiters and waitresses. I'm drinking a quart a day, and I got fired as a waiter. I got into a fight at a party, and a guy kicked my face in, and I didn't look good enough to serve food, so they asked me to stop doing that. And when that happened to me, I went home. I hadn't been home in like 6 months, and I went home and I asked my father. I had no place to go. I was tapped, and I went back, and my dad allowed. He said, "You can move back in the house if you don't drink." And I promised I wouldn't drink. I, of course, lied. I didn't know you could get in trouble stopping drinking. I was drinking a quart a day for the better part of that last year, and when I stopped drinking, I came apart. I was hallucinating. I went to the doctor. My liver, I had an extended liver, you know, not too many 23-year-olds have a enlarged liver, but I did. And I moved back in the house, and I just kind of drank my way through my withdrawal. And when I moved back in the house, I tried to change my life. I thought if I could change the circumstances of my life, that's what I thought was wrong. I didn't, you know. So I got back together with the girl that I had gone with and broken up with for almost a year, and we became engaged and married. And today, she's still my lovely wife, 41 years. And I've been a constant source of growth for her. And I don't think she'd have half the program today if it wasn't for me. I think I have. But I tell you, it's a hell of a treasure to have a partner in the program. It is, I don't know, I'd like to think we'd be married today if we both weren't in the program, but I know that the happiness of our marriage and our relationship certainly has to do with the fact that we are both in the program. It's just a wonderful deal that you tend to look at your own part in it rather than turn the laser on your wife or your wife turning the laser on you. And it really has been a great deal. And then our three boys in recovery, that's been a blessing that's beyond anything we could imagine. But I got back together with Linda. I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern. I bought my first car, and I thought, wow, it's finally going to happen. You're finally going to become an adult. Only I couldn't stop drinking. Now, instead of the, you know, school drunk, I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers. I mean, I stand out like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I am, you know, corporations are tough places for young drunks. They like to have you come in on Mondays and, you know, like to have you stay on Fridays and, you know, lunch hours. I mean, there's a lot of rules. And I used up my sick leave in about the first 2 months I'm there. I mean, I am sleeping at my desk. I am, you know, I'm a mess. I'm really a mess. And after about 5 months, I quit that job. I remember I went back to that man to make amends when I was early in AA, and he said, I just couldn't believe it. He said, you interviewed so well. I mean, it was, so that's the story of my life. My mother always said, Bob, you're not very bright, dress well. And I have, I have tried to do that, and so I leave that job. I get a sales job, thinking it would give me more flexibility, and I'm working at the sales job, and a buddy of mine gets married, and weddings were always good for about a week, and I went out in a 3 or 4 day drunk. I woke up Thursday in July of 1967, and I was tapped. I was my moment of clarity. You look in the mirror. I mean, you're about as disgusted with yourself as you could possibly be. Hadn't been to work in 3 days, and I'm in the same suit that I've been in for a couple of days, and I'm, if you ever felt like a horse's ass, that was certainly the time. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my dad and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem like such a dumb idea, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was worried about, the girls were giving the rings back in those days. We were, they didn't think we were that good of a catch. And but I, you know, found out I was still engaged, and I called work and found out I still had a job, and my parents were still going to allow me to live at home, and I thought that my calling AA was kind of an overreaction. And but you think of it, in 67, not too many 23-year-olds would identify with, now that's just about the time that the treatment phenomenon started to go on, when we started to get a rash of younger people. We didn't have many younger people. But I called AA, and I was curious to see what an alcoholic looked like. So I went and I met these two guys. It was at St. Clair Broiler in St. Paul, Minnesota, and two guys came up and talked to me. And one guy had 6 years and one guy had 6 months. And when you're young and in trouble, you get put in front of a lot of people to try to help you. Judges, lawyers, Indian chiefs, policemen, judge, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, bishops, nuns, priests. I mean, I had been helped a lot. And but you're generally the subject of the conversation, but not a participant in the conversation. You're the. But I had never talked to another person who had a drinking problem. And that day I went out and I talked to these two guys, and they said, we're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We found a solution to our drinking problem. We want to share it with you. We hope it helps you. But if it doesn't, don't worry. For some strange reason, it helps us talking to guys like you. And I thought that's, you know, pretty good. They weren't trying to, wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. They weren't getting a toaster for signing me up. And they told me their drinking story. And it changed my life. We have many traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and probably the most wonderful one of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope. Not our thinking, not our ideology, not our philosophy, not our dogma. We share our lives. There's a power in sharing your life with someone. There's an authenticity in it. And I found the similarity. I identify with those guys about halfway through their story, and that night I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank twice after they called on me. Once after a month, I went on a business trip to the West Coast, and I was told to call AA, and I didn't, and I drank. And then I had almost 3 months sobriety, Linda and I got married in Mexico, you know, where the divers dive off those cliffs. I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And I dove off the public landing, climbed up to about 85 or 90 feet, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. My wife is going absolutely nuts. Here's this horse's ass stuck up on top of this cliff. And I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. I'm looking at the waves, and I'm much too drunk to climb down. And I couldn't climb up. And finally, I figured out, screw it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks, because if I would have jumped, I would have died. You have to get out 30 feet to hit the center of the channel. You can't jump that far. Now, I don't know. I didn't, you know, did not know that fact, which is a pretty good fact to know. And for a number of years, we went down vacation down there with the kids at that same hotel at La Quebrada. And my wife, at my 10th anniversary, my wife gave me a picture that said, "There but for the grace of God." And it was a picture of the chasm at La Quebrada. And we were watching the divers, and I said, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever done." And she said, "Honey, it's not even in the top 10. So, I don't know how you can share a life with someone and see it so differently. You know, I had a number of years ago, I was gaining weight, and I wanted to get some exercise. I told my wife, I'm going to buy a bike. And she said, "Fine." So I got a Harley. And and she got irritated. I mean, you know, I thought it was tougher to please as time went on. And but I came home. I had my last drink on the airplane, December the 10th, 1967. And I came back. I was embarrassed to go to the meeting. She said, "Oh, for God's sakes, call Warren." I called Warren, went to the meeting. I can remember going to my first meeting. Now, I have the same sponsor that I had walking in 1967. And that's, you know, that doesn't happen all that often because people die and relationships change and, you know, and it's more of a father-son relationship today and a family relationship. We go over there and it's like kids visiting dad. It isn't like, you know, it isn't quite like it was when we were starting out. But I wouldn't change it for the world. And his wife was my wife's sponsor, in Alana. So there was this wonderful relationship that we had over years and years and years. And I have had the privilege to do lots of things in Alcoholics Anonymous, all of which are a result of copying my sponsor. I mean, my sponsor was a mailman, but he was the 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He called on more damn people than you could shake a stick at. It was just the amount of, you know, they give commendations in the paper for policemen that would save one or two or three people's lives over a career. And I think if we could really count the number of lives that my sponsor has affected, it would be an astounding number. But I can remember when I came in and I met Warren, he sat me down and he said, "Bob," he said, "alcoholism is a disease." He said, "It's physical, but it's also mental and spiritual. Once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you drink and when you don't drink." Now, the idea that alcoholism could affect me when I wasn't drinking was like rocket science. It was not an obvious idea. It was a whole new idea. He said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous once we take our last drink or drug is we use the 12 steps to change, to find a different way to live that's better than the way we lived before, so that we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we were unwilling or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you're not going to stay. He said, you ever quit? I said, yeah. He said, did it work? I said, no. He said, it didn't work for me either. He said, there's a difference between abstinence and sobriety. Sobriety is abstinence with the program, with the fellowship, with the steps, with the change, with the sponsorship. So there's, when we say sober in AA, we don't mean just abstinent. There's more involved with it. That was like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember the chair I was sitting in when Warren told me that. And I got real active. I went to a hell of a lot of meetings. And in those days, in this late 60s and early 70s, that was when that parade of young people, they started diagnosing alcoholism. We started to have all the treatment that we did when we were in Minnesota, you know, kind of the biggest treatment center thing. So I had a chance to do a lot of 12-step work. Well, my idea was, I was always a guy who, well, like I said, my mother said, you're not very bright, dress well. I always looked good. You know, I was, I did. I interviewed well, you know, but I didn't perform well. And over a period of time, I thought I had like a built-in failure mechanism. You get tired. I mean, if we went around this room and started talking about all the things we never finished, I mean, we'd have a long conversation. And it isn't for lack of talent. It isn't for lack of ability. I mean, it's alcoholism costs you your life. Many of us never got a chance to use the gifts that we were intended to use in the process of our lives. The boxes were still under the piano, still wrapped with the ribbon on top. That's not a small cost, that you never get to be who you're supposed to be in your life because of the disease of alcoholism. So I said, okay, I'll buy it. I'm an alcoholic. And Alcoholics Anonymous has got the answer for alcoholism. Well, if I'm an alcoholic and you got the answer, I got a half a dozen other things that are going on in my life, and if you got the answer, those ought to go away. And it might take a year. From what I can tell, it takes over 41 years to have to have all your defects of character removed. But I was a young guy, and I had a lot of unmanageability in my life. I was how I supported my drinking at Notre Dame. I was a gambler. I was a pool player. I was a card player. I was a backgammon player. So I had, my list of problems were that I had a pretty serious gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week, wasn't it? But I was making $5 to $10 grand a year gambling, playing backgammon. It was like a second job. And I spent more money than I made. Now, if you do that over a long period of time, you're going to end up in debt. I just want to report it to you in case you don't know where that one where that one goes. And we had started to have children, and I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes they made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, immature, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that, but that's an accurate description of how I was. My wife, and I had work issues. I had a little trouble. I had trouble getting to work. I had trouble getting up, which later I found out had to do with when I went to bed. I did not know that at the time that I was as a young guy. So I had trouble getting to work, and I had some trouble staying at work, and I had some trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a pretty good worker. And you laugh at that. You know, it's really funny. You can't have much of a life if you don't know how to work. And there's a lot of people who don't have that issue. You know, it seems like we leak in different places. I mean, there are guys that and gals that have had good work ethic all their life. I didn't have that. I don't know what I was. I was spoiled or a candy ass. I'm not sure. I mean, I worked on construction crews. It wasn't like I didn't know how to work, but I'll explain a little more about that later. But I had very serious problems. And these were not problems that happened monthly. They happened all the time. Not any of the issues I just mentioned to you made my first inventory when I did my first, fourth, and fifth step. My first, fourth, and fifth step was a recitation of the worst things that I had done in my life. I didn't have much insight into the causes and conditions of my alcoholism. It wasn't until later that I got real active in AA. The most important thing for me in my early recovery was a breaking down of my alibi system. I built a wall up between you and me so you couldn't see what was going on in my life. I said, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me because I hate me. And who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient, lousy person I am than me. I'm comparing my inside with your outside. So I built this wall up. When I called AA, I got sick enough and tired enough and afraid enough behind that wall that I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand me 5 more minutes. And for the first time in my life, I tore the wall down. And I shared the whole deck of cards. I never shared the whole deck of cards with anybody. My family had part of it. My wife had part of it. But no one had all of it. And I'd kill you with the piece you didn't have. But when I called AA and continued in conversation with my sponsor, when I took my fourth and fifth step, my wall came down and I made a discovery. And the discovery was that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my experience, not my feelings, not my problems. And I started to have a sense of hope that would work for you, could work for me. Most of us come in here with a profound sense of uniqueness. If you don't lose some of that sense of uniqueness, you are not going to stay. You're going to look for the differences rather than the similarities. And after I tore that wall down and I committed myself to my sobriety, I had a honeymoon of 6 to 9 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. What the circumstances weren't great the first 6 to 9 months, but it was wonderful. I'd ask a question, I'd get an answer. Then after I was sober about 9 months, I'd ask a question, you give me an answer, and I wasn't sure you were right. My ego started to come back. And I didn't have a very good list of my defects of character during my first year, but during my second year, I compiled a pretty good list, and I started to work on the things that the work habits and the money problems and the gambling issues. And my wife was arguing with me because I was so active in AA. I'm going to 6-7 meetings a week, and she's seeing less of me. She's a nurse. She's getting up at 6, and she's coming home, and she's in bed when I come home from the meeting, and we're like ships passing in the night, and she thinks all of a sudden I'm this AA fanatic, and I don't, you know, I want to hang out with 60-year-olds, and we're 23, and, you know, all this stuff. So one by one, I would take these issues on, and I'd try to work on them, and it was like I didn't have a full appreciation that these were things I was supposed to use the program on. It was kind of like, you get me sober and I'll learn how to be a husband. Or you get me sober and I'll learn how to work. You get me, you know. And I didn't know how to do those things. And so I kept having these problems. I remember those problems started to bother me in my first, second, and third year of sobriety. In my fourth and fifth year, they started to bother the crap out of me. In my sixth and seventh year, they started to eat my lunch. And in my sixth and seventh year, I started to think maybe I might have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous because it's not working. I felt like I had sponsees making more progress than I was making. Didn't seem fair, didn't seem right. I remember the new guy had come in with a bushel basket full of manure, and I'd get him a cup of coffee, and we'd sit down after the meeting, and he'd share all the problems, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, you're in the right place. You're just where you're supposed to be. Don't worry about it. Just get a cup of coffee. If you find a sponsor, get into the book, do the best you can with the steps, and stay here and don't drink. You're going to be fine. You see that guy over there? 2 years ago, God, he was a mess. And I said, today he's knocking it out of the park. I said, you're going to be okay. And then I get in the car and I drive home 11 o'clock at night, and I say, Bob, when are you going to be okay? I mean, you're sober 5 years, 6 years, 7 years. You just bought a $400 sport coat at a store that you had a $400 bill at. When are you going to stop buying things with, you know, that you can't afford with money you don't have to impress people you don't like? I mean, you know, I mean that's, I didn't have a very good answer for that one. When are you going to stop gambling? When are you going to learn how to work? And I didn't have a very good answer because I'm sober 7 years and I'm trying pretty bloody hard to change those things, and I feel like I'm on the down escalator walking up. And I kind of knew what the answer was. The answer, I think, had to do, for me, had to do with finding out what God had to do with Wednesday. I had a lot of good examples of recovery. And the people who had what I wanted, who really had the whole deal, had a quality to their lives that I didn't, a depth to their lives I didn't have. And it had to do with something spiritual. And I was so glad that I was taught the difference between religious and spiritual. Because I was Catholic and I went through all the Catholic education. And I think had it been too religious, I would have not stayed. It would, you know, because it would have conflicted or whatever the hell, even though I wasn't a very good practicing Catholic at the time. But they had a spiritual quality that I could detect. And they really understood the relationship of the program and the relationship of God to what they did in their daily lives. And I didn't. Or I didn't fully understand it. And I sure as hell wasn't able to implement it to the degree, to effectively. Because my life, if that's all there was, it wasn't enough. It wasn't enough. I had to deal with these issues. I had to be able to support my family. I had to be, you know, and I'm trying pretty hard and it's not working. But the problem I had is I went to God, if I went to God and turned myself in, you would not have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God would want me to do. If I had the conversation with God, God'd say, what do you want? I said, I want to turn myself in. Why? Well, I'm 8 years sober and my pants are on fire. That's why. Will you help me? God says, yeah, I'll help you. Okay, now I'm going to say to God what everybody says to me when they come over to the house with all their problems. What do I do? Because that's what we want to know. What do I do? Now, you know, stop gambling. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. You know. Get on a budget. I think it's an Al-Anon term. It's a harsh word that I'm not sure applies to Alcoholics Anonymous. Be kind and loving to your children and your wife and stop gambling. And I'm going to say, hell, if I knew how to do all those things, I wouldn't need God. What the hell do you think I've been trying to do for the last 8 years? That's exactly what I've been trying to do. And I haven't been successful at doing it. So what's the use of developing a relationship with your God of your understanding if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? And I was stuck in that place for 3 years. And I think out of fear, you know, and I thought, God, do I have to go to a program for gambling? Do I have to go to a program for spending? Do I have to go? I mean, I thought, you're going to be a busy guy. I mean, already I'm more busy than my... And it kind of felt like the rest of my life felt. It felt like you did a great start, but you're not a good finisher. This is where you always end up. Everybody's patting you on the head, telling you what a great job you're doing, and you're not doing a very great job. Out of fear of both getting drunk and out of fear of just continuing to be a sober jerk, I went back through the steps third time. Step one was a no-brainer. You know, I was powerless and unmanageable. You didn't have to be a rocket scientist to figure that one out. What fooled me? Step two. I believed it for us, but not for me. I really believed it for us. I mean, I was a pretty good 12-stepper. But I lost the belief for me because I'm 8 years sober and, you know, I'm on the down escalator, baby. It's not working. And I had to regain the second step. And I started to see men and women in my group with bigger problems than I had, with smiles on their faces, with dignity walking through the walls that I was trying to walk around. And I regained a sense that I believed that God was going to restore Bob to sanity. I did the third step on my knees with my sponsor in his office. We didn't do that much in those days. But I started to go to conferences, and I would listen to people in California, and thought, well, I'm going to try it. You know, so I, a little awkward, but I did it. Then I did a four-step, and I said, my previous ones I'd done with clergy, and I said to them, when I'm done with this fifth step, I should be careful, because whatever you recommend to me, I'm going to do. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I am so goddamn sick and tired of being me. I just can't tell you how tired I am. And we did my fifth step. And he said to me, Bob, you have a lot of problems around work, money, success, and failure. My dad was a pretty successful guy, and he was kind of my hero, and I thought I'd never going to be as good as my old man. He said, I think you got to go to a psychologist who works with people in business. I did not want to do that. That kind of felt like there was something odd with me, you know, something that my program wasn't good enough, you know, that, hello. So I got a referral. I called up the psychologist, and he said, will you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life. If you can't help me without getting my parents involved, please refer me to someone who can. Will you get your wife involved? I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. It's a much different conversation when your spouse is in the room than when you're in the room alone. We get your kids involved. I did not want my children involved. I was embarrassed and ashamed of my sometimes rage. But I said, yeah. And I went to that psychologist, I don't know, six months, with my wife and children. And I made one of the most important discoveries in my recovery with the help of that psychologist. And what I discovered was fear. You know, I had done three inventories. My fear inventory had to do with snakes, dogs, and tall buildings. I had no insight into... I remember one day I was telling them that I had this small company that I was working with, and it was going broke, and I busted my ass 2-3 hours a day, but just not working. And he said to me, why are you so afraid of failing? And I literally wanted to punch him. I was as close. I literally wanted to jack him. And I said to him, look, you're a doctor. I said, you know, when you go bankrupt, you know, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and 6 months you're making $100,000 again. I said, I'm a guy. I'm in the real estate investment business. I'm about to lose everything I had. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I'm going to lose everything I have. He looked at my wife and he said, Linda, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? My wife said, no, it wouldn't lose me. And he asked the kids. The kids said, nope. If you can't lose, you can't play. And what I discovered is I was scared to death of life. I was afraid of being the responsibility of being a husband. I was afraid of being a father. I was afraid of failure. I was afraid of success. And, I was like the fish in the ocean that Chuck Chamberlain talked about when the one fish looked over at the other fish and he says, isn't the ocean wonderful? And the other fish looked over and said, what's the ocean? The air to the bird, the water to the fish, the fear unto myself. I didn't get it. And not too long after that, I was home. I had a terrible day. I went to work late. I left early. I got in a backgammon game. I won $600. I missed dinner. I missed the AA meeting. I got in a fight with my wife, and I slapped one of the kids. One of those things you'd like to have videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do for you. And and I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, it happened again. Weren't you there? And I said, yeah, I was there. But it's so habitual, it's almost as if I'm in a blackout. I don't even have to think about it. It's kind of like, and all of a sudden I realized that was a bunch of crap. I realized that my life was the way it was because I designed it that way. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble whenever the hell I wanted to gamble, for as much money as I wanted to gamble and not have problems because of gambling. I wanted money without work. I wanted my wife's and children's love and affection without spending time with them. Not a very good design. And all of a sudden I realized that I had tried as hard as I could to change, and I had failed. Now, I had that idea before, but for some reason, at that moment, that idea was okay. It never had been okay before. And I had this idea, maybe I was exactly where I was supposed to be, and I was given the opportunity to take the 6th and the 7th step of the program of AA. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God, not Bob, remove our defects of character. The seventh step said that we humbly ask and remove our shortcomings. I had spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power. I have the responsibility. But I'm the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. And that night I got down on my knees. I took the sixth and the seventh step, and four of the major problems in my life disappeared that night, such as the power of the program and the power of God. I had to put some things in place to support that. I turned the finances over to my wife, who doesn't have the issues with money that I had. I went on an allowance, and she got the check. We were out of trouble in about 12 months. She had this technique where she could pay part of a bill. God damnedest thing I have ever... I thought, you know, honey, if you only pay half of it, you're going to think you don't have the money. I never would put it in the hat even, you know. I started dating my wife every Friday night. I dated my wife every Friday night for 30 years. So one night a week, we had a real live dangerous date. And that was one of the best things we ever did. We had, you know, one night a week, we had each other's undivided attention. It was really a terrific thing. We didn't go out with anybody else. We just went out. I had to learn how to be romantic with my wife. We used to go out and we'd talk about kids and bills. That wasn't how we fell in love. I mean, it just, you know, so I had to learn, I'd have to go to Chicago and check up and learn how to be, you know, we went back to being like we were when we courted each other. And it was an important thing. I made appointments with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and when I'd leave work and what I'd do. And I remember I was selling real estate investments, and I went out to General Mills, and I was supposed to go sell this investment for $10,000. And if he bought it, I would make $1,000. And I went up there knowing it wouldn't. I had to read the third step prayer to get my butt out of the car to go in this building. And remember, I went up there and I talked to him, and he bought it. And I made $1,000. And I'm in the elevator on the way down, and I had this thought. You know, if a guy did that regularly, I thought, you know, and that night I quit gambling. And my life took off like it was on a rocket ship. All of a sudden, the guy who couldn't work, we built a company up with 400 or 500 employees, and I made enough money to burn a wet elephant over the next 10 years. And that was my deeply shallow period. And I got the big house and I got a big Mercedes and a little Mercedes. And I'm the guy who's in the expensive suit coming to the meeting in his Mercedes thinking that God has blessed me because of what a wonderful AA I was. How would you have liked to have me in your group? I was just, there are problems with failure, but there are also problems with success. There's an arrogance that I had that was invisible to me and I didn't see. So there's, on each side of that coin, there are issues and problems and personality things that we have to deal with. And then in 1986, they passed the Tax Act. And between 1986 and 1994, I lost everything I had. I lost $8 million in 3 years. And I was literally on the verge of bankruptcy. Just before that, I went to a man and I asked him to be my spiritual director. And he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "I want to be less materialistic and more loving." Within 6 months, I started to lose everything I had. And I went... I went back to George. I said, "We got to talk." I said, "What I want to do is keep the stuff and be less materialistic." And that was at the same time when I was in a thing. And you know, when we talk in AA, sometimes we talk like we really have it all together. I'm 40 years sober, and I could give you a lecture or a sharing on any step or tradition, or I know a lot about AA. And I could share back with you like about that period of time, and it would sound like the program really stood me in good stead and I did a great job. But I want you to know, for about a year and a half, I was under my desk sucking my thumb in the fetal position. I was a basket case, going to 5 meetings a week. This was not like losing my changing my clothes. This is like tearing the skin off my body. If any of you in the room are praying to be a millionaire, include the idea of keeping it. Never occurs to us if we ever got it that we wouldn't keep it, you know. I was in as much pain as I've ever been in. And thank God for AA. Thank God for my wife. Thank God for my sponsor. I think without that stability in my life, I would have done harm to myself. It was the toughest period of time I ever had. But I think during every tough period of time, there's something to learn. And I was supposed to learn about who I was with money and who I was without money. I didn't like the school. I didn't, you know, but the lesson's been important to me. I'm having the lesson again right now. This is the new Lent. You know, someone called this financial collapse. I heard an Irish lady came back from Ireland and said they're calling it the new Lent in Ireland. You know, asking each other, what are you giving up? You know. So what I learned, that my alcoholism was still alive in my abstinence and in my sobriety, that the emotional and mental aspects of my, you know, the physical aspect of alcoholism was gone, but not the mental and emotional and spiritual aspect, that I had to continue to use the program for the living issues that I have today, but it works. It really does. And that I am powerless in ways that I don't. And if you're not careful, you end up thinking that you're not powerless. You end up thinking that you know about the program. You end up thinking that you know what to do. The problem is not knowing what to do. We all know what to do. Every guy that comes over to my house to sit down and talk to me and have a cup of coffee with the problems that they have, they always know what to do. Once in a while, I say, okay, quiet. You know, talking for a half hour, they do the dump. And I say, pretend I came to your house with this thing, what would you tell me to do? They always know. They just can't do it. They know what to do. So it's not lack of information, even though we always want to go back and inventory it. It's lack of power. And the answer is surrender. But how do you tell someone, because that's an act of God, if it was mechanical? That's one of the things today, is that there's so much teaching about the program that sometimes we get the impression that if I get the right information, the best tip, listen to the guys who are really the best technicians on the steps, so there's just something that I'm not doing right. And there's always something we can learn in that process. There's always something in the study of the book or listening to someone. But it's not technique, it's a matter of heart. The program is not a change. It's a change of being, not doing. And when we come to it only with our minds, we always want to know, what do I do? And it's not really about doing. It's about being. And when you surrender, when you really contact your higher power, it changes who you be. And nothing looks the same. That surrender that we had when we first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, it all looked different. From that moment on, when I came in there and I took the first step and they explained what alcoholism was, for the next 3 or 4 or 5 months, it was like magic. I had an explanation of my life that I had never had before, and a peace in very difficult times that I had never had before. It's pretty hard for us. It's not mechanical. If it was mechanical, every time you had a serious problem, you just have to say the third step prayer and snap your fingers and you'll be back in Kansas. But it isn't that simple. So we're granted a reprieve contingent upon the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And that's what our job is in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to maintain our spiritual condition. The good news is we have a wonderful path to do that. We have a village of people who are trying to support each other on our walk in recovery. And we have sponsorship and steps and meetings, which are things to do. So often people who have serious problems like ours that aren't in the fellowship, they don't know what to do, where to go. I mean, if we can sit, you know, 5 meetings a week, sit in a room with people who are trying to encourage us to get our lives better. I mean, don't you all have brothers or sisters or neighbors or friends that you'd, you know, like to have that for them? You know, that they would have a place that they could in the context of discussing spiritual principles that they could access and start to put these things in order in their lives, so life wouldn't be such a bloody mystery, and to go do that. But the world is a difficult place today. When I got sober in 1967, I think the world supported recovery more than it does today. I think today the world supports addiction. It's nuts out there. I mean, you can today, I'm so glad they didn't have the internet when I was first sober. That, I mean, you can get pornography drugs. I mean, you can buy drugs over the thing, you know, without ever leaving your room. Today they mail you a credit card with $5,000, you know, I mean, I know I wouldn't have taken them, but just on the off chance. Just on the off chance that I might have, I would have buried myself so deep. It's, baby, if you ever wonder why you're struggling, there's a 30-mile-an-hour wind out there. And it's raining. It's different playing golf in a 30-mile-an-hour wind when it's raining than it is on a sunny day without wind. And that's what we're playing in today. And so when you're not grounded in the program, and the power isn't mine. What I discovered, you know, I don't change. God changes me. A doctor doesn't heal. He creates an aseptic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place, and God heals. A farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, creates a fertile environment with growth can take place, and God grows, and I don't change. I create an atmosphere in which change can take place, and God changes me. And that's an attitude of open-mindedness, honesty, and willingness, and the attitude, I think, involved in the sixth and the seventh step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it isn't a matter of just knowing. It isn't a matter of technology. It isn't a matter of more information. We have all the information that we need. You don't have to do it all the same, but you have to do it enough the same. You have to access the principle, the core of the spiritual principle. But because we're all different, there will be people in this room who will do it in a much simpler way than a guy or gal who really likes to do a 40-page inventory. I mean, we're different, and there are we will come about and participate in those steps, but we have to have the change of heart that's involved in that process. So not only do you have to study the text and try to do these steps to the best of your ability, but part of what sobriety is more than anything else is a gift. And part of what I think we have to do is maintain the attitude of the recipient of a gift, in the relationship of the recipient to the person who's going to give the gift. And it's kind of there's a friendship, there's a love, there's an openness, there's a receptivity. Because just going with your mind will not work. Your mind is part of the problem. It's what's driving us nuts, that incessant conversation that's going on. That you want to know what your mind looks like? Go turn on CNN for an hour and a half. It's just conjecture and what ifs and all the sorts of craziness. And but it has a seduction to it that is just unbelievable, that you almost sometimes can't turn those programs off. The peace that we're looking for, the quiet that we're looking for. God has found, the language of God is silence. That's why people who are new have so much trouble accessing the spiritual. There's just too much noise in their head. But after they start to do the steps and after they start to make the change, the mind starts to quiet down. And when the mind starts to quiet down, you can start to hear and access the deeper parts of you, the knower, the higher power, the spirit of the universe. And I am so glad that I have, you know, I think today that my life is better than it would have been had I never had the disease of alcoholism. That I have literally, because of my disease, been forced to do things that have made my life better that I would not have done. So, if I have anything to say tonight, I want to say that AA works. I know more about who I am when I'm in this room than I do any place else in my life. Thank you for my life.